This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Rebecca Thiel speaks with a Michigan State University entomologist who explains why a hot, dry summer can increase the risk of West Nile virus. But first, three Republicans are seeking their party's nomination for State House in the 66th District. That seat includes Van Buren and Northwest Kalamazoo County. It's open this year because Eric Nesbitt cannot run again due to term limits. Greg Kolich is seeking the Republican nomination for State House. Greg Kolich, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Gordon.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born in Pennsylvania. I've been in Michigan since 1956. Lincoln Park Public Schools. Started at Western in, I think, 1975 and got sidetracked, and I took in classes and classes and classes, and I finally told my advisor, well, just mail me a diploma. And was a Bachelor of Science degree in the teaching industrial education, vocational industrial education, which I decided I didn't want to do it for a living anyway. Enlisted in the National Guard in 1981 and retired just over 20 years later. And been with my current employer for the last 30 years. And I'll probably stay there for a few more.
And what kind of work do you do now?
I'm a machinist. I get to make things. You know, they give me a big playground to run around in and all kinds of neat tools. I can make things and just enjoy myself all day. So it's hardly like work.
What would you like to do if you are elected to the State House?
I have three priorities that I've not heard anybody else talk about. 100% pro-life. And we have to take that as to mean that the life begins right the moment of conception, and killing it just capriciously after that obviously is murder. Michigan's right to life recognizes protecting the life of the mother, but basically nothing else. And I guess it doesn't make any more sense to kill that little kid after so many weeks or so many months or how about 3 years or 14 years. If we start the life at conception and take care of it, protect it, That covers it lifelong. The next thing is being 100% pro-family. All of our government everywhere, local, state, federal, counties, and everywhere you look, has various programs in place that discourage families from forming, mainly in the form of welfare checks. We have similar programs that discourage families from staying together. They encourage them to break up because of welfare checks. Our government encourages lazy, useless people to be lazy, useless people. I think we need to cut that out. And instead of subsidizing people with welfare checks, we could eliminate the income taxes. It's not worth the state's trouble to go to collect income taxes on small amounts, small payrolls, small paydays. For someone who wants to form a family and wants to get together and wants to take care of themselves and be self-sufficient, it's not in the government's best interest to hit them with an income tax. If we didn't charge people income tax, say, on the first $25,000 that they made, I think that would give more people an incentive to go to work and take care of their own families and do things for themselves. And we have examples over there on Lake Street. You know, they're greatly expanding their welfare office over there, Family Children Services, more and more expense to the taxpayer. The taxpayers are subsidizing kids adopted through the foster method. The taxpayers are paying for them. You know, we have the government subsidizing the wrong things.
Okay, 100% pro-life, 100% pro-family. You said there's a third one?
Yep, 100% pro-gun, and that has to do with Michigan's Castle Doctrine. We need to let people know loud and clear that, you know, it's completely acceptable for people to defend themselves.
Are there people who aren't defending themselves right now?
I think there are some people that would hesitate to, and some other people that would argue that, no, you can't defend yourself. You let that thug, that burglar, that whatever run right over you. That's okay. We can't touch that person. There are lots of those people around that don't recognize self-defense. Michigan's Castle Doctrine does. It gives people the opportunity under the law, if they choose to fight back.
Okay, so the law is already there right now.
It's already there, but okay. A lot of people don't understand it, and they don't recognize it, and they would even argue, hey, that's not good. Shooting burglars is not good.
Okay, but I guess I'm wondering, as a state lawmaker, what are you going to do? I mean, if it's already in law, you say there's people who don't know about it. I mean, the people who don't argue, I mean, or who argue against it, let's say, I mean, if they don't wish to defend their own castle, isn't mm-hmm. that their choice?
Yeah, that's their choice. But we have people, we have law enforcement people, we have social worker people, other do-gooder people that don't recognize that right.
Well, what are they doing? I mean, I guess I'm trying to see what is the thing that's actually happening.
You can look back, say, in Kalamazoo County, Van Buren County. It's not too difficult to ask, and they'll tell you. People that have defended themselves, which every now and then results in a fatality. Those people are investigated. Sometimes a crime is assumed. Sometimes a homeowner is presumed guilty and has to prove innocence, despite our castle doctrine. That needs to be made much more clear, and people's right to self-defense needs to be absolutely unquestioned.
Let me talk about some other issues for a moment. Educators in the public system right now are saying that they may sue the state over a provision in the education budget signed by Governor Snyder, which does allow for reimbursing private schools for some expenses. How much of a wall do you think there should be between public funding and private education?
I think all education is education should all be funded equally.
So private parochial schools should get
absolutely.
The same thing.
So absolutely.
Would you want to change the Michigan Constitution, which right now says otherwise?
You betcha. Right now, we're suffering under a Michigan Constitution that presumes that the state knows better than everybody else, and the state's going to tell everybody what to do. I don't believe that for a second.
But you want to still put state money into those schools?
Oh, absolutely. If a church wants to run a school, that's their choice. Let them do it. If a private organization, if an employer wants to run a school, let them do it. A school is a school. The state should not have a monopoly on that.
Do you want to put more money into education, or do you just want to divvy the pie up?
No, I would never increase the money that's in education. It's being way overfunded now. I would divvy that money up.
Way overfunded?
Way overfunded.
Why do you think that?
Well, everywhere you go, you drive across Michigan, there are hundreds of separate school districts with separate administration buildings, separate superintendents, separate contacts, separate busing, separate food, separate everything. That's just not necessary.
So you would favor consolidation of school districts,
right.
then?
I see things that could be privatized. Things like busing could be privatized, transportation is transportation, all kinds of food service could be privatized, grounds maintenance could be privatized. I can't see having a separate school superintendent every 50 miles you drive down the road. That's just nonsensical.
As a state lawmaker, what would you actually propose? Would you propose carrots out there to try to encourage consolidation, or would you propose just simply deciding that some school districts are going to be put out of business?
I wouldn't worry about putting school districts out of business, but if the student funding per head was available to anybody that wanted to run, say, a middle school, supply and demand would work that out.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're speaking with Greg Kolich. He is a candidate for the Republican nomination in the 66th State House District. That includes Van Buren County as well as Northwest Kalamazoo County. Do you think that state lawmakers need to be looking to put more money into roads than what they approved late last year?
I think the voters said absolutely no, and they meant it. The state has money already to spend for roads. They're already collecting taxes for roads. They need to use it. They don't need more. They need to use what they have.
Did the voters say no completely to more revenue, or did they just say no to one idea which was very complex and involved moving a lot of money around and was hard to understand?
The question before the taxpayers included a whole lot more than money for roads, which I think was inappropriate. There was a yes or no on a lot of things, and the roads were part of it. Even if the road money was broken out as a separate item, my own vote would still be no, because the state already collects money every single day for roads. They don't need more.
They don't need more. I mean, because there are other states which, you know, state officials will point to and say they actually put a lot more money into roads per capita than we do.
Well, that's fine. What I've looked at bridges, I've looked at roads, I've looked at support columns literally falling apart a year after they were built. That's incomprehensible. They can do a better job for no more money or less money.
What about water infrastructure? We had the problem in Flint with lead ending up in the water. Mm-hmm. There's lead pipes that run mm-hmm. not just in Flint, but in a lot of other older cities. Mm-hmm. Do you think the state should be making that a priority?
Nope, not at all. Flint caused its own problem. Their own local officials caused it years before it made the news. Years before. It was not a sudden thing. Flint's own local officials screwed that up thoroughly.
You don't think the state had any role in that?
Nope, none. The EPA, the DEQ may have displayed some incompetence there. I think the governor was too quick to say anything that he didn't know anything about. But Flint's own local officials caused their own local problem years before it hit the news.
Not the emergency manager who ordered the water switch.
The Flint's, if, according to the reports I heard in the paper, Flint's own local officials were not running their water system competently long before the emergency manager came along.
But the emergency manager was the one who said, take us off the Detroit water system and switch us to the Flint River.
I read that in the paper.
Okay, you don't think that puts some responsibility at the doorstep of the emergency manager?
He may have made a bad decision, but Flint's own local people, the people that were directly in charge of running their water system, made lousy decisions long before that emergency manager came along.
Such as?
Maintenance. You can't run a water system into the ground. You can't run it till it crumbles. It needs continuous maintenance. Then they didn't do that.
You mentioned earlier that you are 100% pro-gun.
Yes.
Would you put any sort of regulations on things like open carry? Do you think people should be able to have guns out in the open wherever they wish?
It doesn't bother me any. What bothers me is the government saying, we know more than you do, and we're going to make a lot of rules. I mistrust the government far more than I mistrust my neighbor. Bank robbers are going to be bank robbers. Burglars are going to be burglars. No law is going to change that.
Do you think it is reasonable to put restrictions on, say, schools, certain, you know, zones, courthouses? We just, as we speak on Monday, by the way, I should let our listeners know, we're speaking on Monday. There's been a shooting outside the Berrien County Courthouse, so we don't know very much as we talk. But, you know, should places like that be an area where someone can openly carry a gun?
Oh, absolutely. Every big shooting that's made the news has been in a so-called no-gun zone. Wonder why?
Well, actually, the one in Oregon was not a gun-free zone. It was a community college, which is an open carry campus, and there were people who had guns, and they chose not to get them out.
That's their choice.
Right, because they were afraid that if they got them out and the police came upon the scene, they'd have their guns out.
That has happened.
That's just part of the... part of what happens.
That has happened to people. That literally has happened to people. When the police arrive on the scene, they don't know who is who. But for the government to start restricting things like that, to say, well, we got to reduce the number of murders, I'll believe that they're serious about it when they get the drunk drivers off the road, when they get the drug addicts out of burglaring, breaking into houses, when we have secretaries of state and when we have candidates for the president that are breaking laws all over the place, I'll believe they're serious about when they start attacking those things.
So I've been asking other Republicans this question. I will ask you, and I'm guessing that if you're out talking to people, you're probably getting some questions about a gentleman named Donald Trump.
Yep.
Do you think he can make a good president if he's elected?
I don't know. He's a big question mark. I don't know what Cruz would do. I look at what Bernie has said as with just, I'm incredulous. Where'd he come up with this? I wrote Bernie off as being crazy, Clinton off as being criminal. Trump has a big question mark. I have no idea what he'll do. I don't think that he has much respect for the Constitution or the rule of law. Some people are making noise to get Ted Cruz in there.
It's a little late, isn't it?
But I think it's a little bit late. People are going to have a choice, I think, to vote for a big question mark Trump or, I think, a true loser, lifelong loser, Hillary.
Did you vote in the Republican presidential primary?
Last year?
No, the presidential primary in March.
The primary, yes. I voted for Trump.
You voted for Trump in the primary?
I thought Trump was more electable than Cruz.
Greg Kolich, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
Greg Kolich is one of three Republicans who is seeking his party's nomination in the 66th State House District. That includes Van Buren and Northwest Kalamazoo County. Interviews with the other two candidates for the Republican nomination in the 66th State House District can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A hot and dry summer may mean fewer mosquitoes, but a Michigan State University entomology professor says that the mosquitoes that are found may also pose a greater threat of carrying the West Nile virus. WMUK's Rebecca Thiel spoke with Michigan State's Ned Walker, who tracks mosquito-borne diseases in the state.
Why does this pattern contribute to West Nile?
Well, it may seem somewhat paradoxical to people that hot and dry conditions promote a mosquito-borne disease like West Nile. But here in Michigan, as in elsewhere, that virus is carried by a mosquito called Culex pipiens. And that mosquito's biology is not associated with lots of rainfall because the larval stages live in water, of course, but they live in places that are mostly created by people, like the catch basins along city streets, abandoned swimming pools,
old
water
tires,
treatment lagoons. And then one of the more common urban and suburban sources of them is what we call detention and retention basins, which are now built to drain away water and hold it that's associated with large parking lots and impervious surfaces, like a parking lot outside a shopping mall, for example, has to have these to hold the water for a while. And there they become very common. And so all of those places produce these mosquitoes, and those are largely independent of rainfall in terms of their filling. Even the street catch basins have a sump below the inlet and outlet pipes, and those hold water even during a drought. And when there's rainfall, they're washed out and the mosquito populations are reduced. The main thing, however, is the warm weather. And what that does is it drives accelerates the process of virus transmission. You know, mosquitoes are animals, they're cold-blooded. And so the warmer it is, the faster things happen. And mosquitoes get the virus infection by feeding on infected birds. And then once a mosquito's gotten a blood meal from an infected bird, the virus has to grow inside the body of the mosquito. And it grows faster when it's warmer. So we developed a forecasting system based on temperature and rainfall. And the critical period is actually June, even a few-week period within June. And using a base temperature and then accumulating the amount of heat that occurs during the period of time above this base temperature, we can calculate the risk for the increase in the mosquito's population's infection rate for the virus. And then we can also estimate the risk of human cases.
Here it says that we're expecting an outbreak similar to those in 2002 and 2012. You know, in comparison, using this forecast, where might that be? Where might 2016 fall? Will it be worse than 2002 and 2012, in the middle? You know, what's, I guess, how bad is bad?
Right. That's sort of relative to everybody's thinking, of course. And most of the human cases occur in our urban areas of the state. So Grand Rapids is one area that tends to have lots of human cases, and also Southeast Michigan and the Detroit metropolitan area. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a risk in other areas, too. You can even have human cases in some rural areas, but most of the cases are concentrated in our urban areas. And that's because, as I've mentioned, this mosquito that carries the virus is quite urbanized and associated with the way people modify the environment and, in particular, channel and hold water at various sources. 2002 was our first big outbreak here. You have to remember that West Nile virus came into the country in 1999. It somehow came across the Atlantic Ocean from the Old World and first invaded New York City. In fact, it was in the borough of Queens where it showed up. None of us knew what was going to happen after that. We thought maybe it would be an isolated event and would go away. But instead, it rapidly swept across North America, and by 2004, it had reached the West Coast in California. So in 2002 was our first big experience of West Nile virus in Michigan, and that happened to be a hot, dry year, and we had 650 cases and about 50 deaths that year. And then we've had various levels of high to low virus transmission depending upon the weather. And West Nile virus has not gone away. It's endemic in our state now. It's here every year. but the amount of it, the activity, as we call it, is low or high, depending upon our weather conditions. If it's a cool, wet summer, the virus is still out there in nature being transmitted between mosquitoes and birds, but at a much lower level than if it's a hot, dry summer.
Now, just to be clear, would you say that having a hot, dry summer, we actually get less mosquitoes in general, taking in all of the different species of mosquito? However, the ones that survive are more deadly because they carry this virus?
That's right. We have about 60 different species of mosquitoes in Michigan, and many of them are associated with lots of rainfall, and that's because the eggs are laid in places where rainfall inundates the environment, for example, low-lying ditches, grassy meadows, places like that where the eggs are out there waiting for the water to arrive. And those are typically our pest mosquitoes. They're not carriers of this virus, but they're mostly, you know, nuisance mosquitoes. And we have very few of those this year, mainly because we've had deficits of rainfall. I think May and June are both, each month is down about an inch and a half of rain from average. So we're in a sort of a drought condition, basically. And it's been hot as well. So those mosquitoes, the pest mosquitoes, are very low in numbers. However, the Culex pipiens mosquito is not dependent on those patterns of rainfall, and its egg biology is very different. The female mosquitoes lay the eggs after they take blood, and that mosquito species lays a clutch of eggs right on top of a body of water. And then those eggs hatch fairly quickly, and then the larvae live in the water. And so they're independent of rainfall events that inundate low-lying areas like I mentioned, roadside ditches, grassy meadows, places like that.
So basically you're saying that just because you don't see mosquitoes, if you are out for a long period of time or walking in the woods, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't go without bug spray.
Right. And it really kind of creates a problem for people because of that perception that there are no mosquitoes. And further, the mosquito we're talking about, Culex pipiens, is very urbanized, and it's called the northern house mosquito. And we suspect it actually enters houses and bites people late at night. And it's very good at sneaking into houses. For example, it's common for people to leave a back door propped open if they're, say, barbecuing on a back deck, and they'll leave the door open, or if they want their dog to be able to run in and out during the summertime, they'll just leave a door open or maybe open a window, or perhaps the screens are not repaired properly and there are holes in screens, things like that that allow those mosquitoes to actually come indoors. And so the biting behavior of the mosquito is very different than the ones that we might experience right at dusk. And those mosquitoes actually bite very late at night also. They might bite after midnight. They might bite indoors. And so that's not the typical time that people put on repellent. For example, I don't know anybody who puts on mosquito repellent right before they go to bed.
Right. You know, is there anything to do other than don't open your door at night?
Well, you know, I'm an advocate of community action for things like this. I mean, there are mosquito control systems that communities can use. Many of them involve trying to reduce the production of mosquitoes from the water sources we've mentioned. They can't be dumped out. You can't dump out an abandoned swimming pool, and you can't empty out thousands of street catch basins. But you can treat them. And there are communities that have adopted programs like this, including those in Michigan. We have some counties and some townships that use tax millages to fund mosquito abatement programs. And some of those tax millage dollars go towards abating the Culex pipiens mosquito populations in their areas. And they're quite effective. Of course, that does require that communities organize and consider having a program like that. And that's gets into the area of politics, which is different than biology.
You know, are there any studies on why the mosquito tends to favor these urban, more standing water areas? Do they need that water throughout their larval cycle?
That's right. This is a mosquito species that is associated with more organically laden and polluted type water. The females are the blood feeders. There are male and female mosquitoes, and only the females take blood. They use that blood to develop eggs. And then once the eggs are developed inside their bodies, then they go lay their eggs somewhere. And Culex pipiens lays its eggs as a raft right on top of water. And the female mosquito seems to be adapted to locating bodies of water that are pretty smelly, that have organic material in them. As I mentioned, one of their habitats or places where they like to lay their eggs and where the larvae develop are wastewater treatment lagoons. Another one is, and these have proliferated in our urban environments, and suburban environments, are abandoned swimming pools. That was more of a problem during the economic downturn of the late 2000s when we had the mini depression starting in 2007 and people just couldn't pay to keep up with their swimming pools. And so there was a lot of abandoned swimming pool situations all over the place, both underground and above ground ones. And with the water in those, it would just accumulate dead leaves and grass clippings, and all of that would just form this organic material that was perfect for the breeding of those mosquitoes. Then we have our street catch basins, which are designed to take water from the streets and accumulate it and move it away back into the watershed. But all of those, each catch basin has a sump that's below the inlet and outlet pipes, and that sump is there to accumulate material that comes off of the street and doesn't clog the pipes, and they're cleaned out every once in a while by municipal crews. But those have water in them, and they get water, for example, from when people water their lawns. It drains off the curb and goes into those, the occasional rainfall. And that organic material, the mosquitoes will actually go through the grate down into that body of water and lay their eggs on top of the water that's down there. So the mosquitoes are well adapted to human-made water and then human-made habitats that have water in them and organic material. So that's why West Nile is mostly kind of an urban and suburban phenomenon.
So we thus far only have, I believe, two counties, but this was last time I checked, as of perhaps 3 o'clock yesterday, that have been shown to have mosquitoes that carry West Nile. So should we be this worried about this yet?
Well, you have to remember that most places in Michigan don't do any surveillance at all. So when a county reports that they have positive mosquitoes, and my lab does the testing for that program, by the way, you know, we don't receive mosquitoes from Kalamazoo, for example. Nobody is collecting them and sending them from there. So we have no idea if the West Nile virus activity is low or high there. The same for most parts of the state. Grand Rapids, for example, which is an area that tends to have human cases, they don't do surveillance either in Kent County or in the city of Grand Rapids. In most of the southeastern municipalities, the city of Detroit, Wayne County, Oakland County, the others, they do either none or very little surveillance. So we don't know. What you just mentioned of counties that reported are just a few that happen to have mosquito control programs, and they do lots of surveillance. They put out mosquito traps, sort them, send them in for testing, and we report back. And so that's why there are these few reports. It's unfortunately, without good surveillance, we can't make strong statements about the risk. But we do have this forecast model based on weather, and that's been quite reliable so far.
Ned Walker is a professor of entomology at Michigan State University who tracks mosquito-borne diseases in the state. He spoke with WMUK's Rebecca Thiel. You can hear Rebecca Thiel's story on mosquitoes and West Nile virus this afternoon on All Things Considered. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.